Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is, believe it or not, the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. The reason I say believe it or not is we're actually taping this on Tuesday, but that's a long story. We no longer have to begin with Colonel Vindman because the election is over. We are, however, going to replace Colonel Vindman with something a little bit more edgy, how shall I say. So I used to love to read The Nation magazine for one reason, Calvin Trillin. I would run, I would grab my Nation, and I'd say, so what has he put together in incredible verse? Well, I have a friend who writes political verse, political limericks. And I reached out to him this week and I said, you wanna be my Calvin Trillin? He said, well, let's try it out, Arnie. So this will be day two of the limericks of my friend who is writing political verse. And here is his verse. His super spreader tour has finally ended, with no concern for those who attended. Himself he did promote, just to get their vote. My God, to what depths he's descended. So everyone, with that in mind, let's introduce my first guest. He is the editor at large at The American Prospect. His name is Harold Meyerson. He used to write for The Washington Post. He is fabulous, and not only is he sometimes very pithy, but he's also very edgy on occasion as well. So I think the idea that we begin with a political limerick is totally appropriate for you, Harold Meyerson. So I was looking at the piece that you wrote today, which is Tuesday, and obviously this is going to be heard on Thursday, and you decided to make your picks for what's going to be happening on Tuesday night or Wednesday. And as you pointed out, you were totally wrong in 2016.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about what is possible, because as I looked at your list, the possible would be an incredible blowout. An incredible blowout against Donald Trump would be, I think, a powerful sort of testament to voter passion, to people being re-engaged in the political process, to people to understanding that votes have consequences. So with that in mind, let's look at your original piece that you had in The Prospect today, Tuesday, and begin there, because I think it really does speak to what we hope will be the result, not only because it moves Donald Trump out, but it means that people are beginning to find their voting muscle.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to bother with explaining why California goes Democratic and West Virginia and Idaho go Republican. But focusing on groups of swing states, and there really are two groups of swing states in this election. There are the states of the industrial, or in some ways post-industrial Midwest, that swung to Trump in the last election, which had been regarded as the blue wall states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And the whole Sun Belt, which really has been the Republicans' electoral base since Richard Nixon and since Kevin Phillips developed the Southern strategy for Nixon in 1968, and, you know, who's, even before Nixon, sort of the prophet of this was Barry Goldwater, who got wiped out by Lyndon Johnson, but carried South Carolina and Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia in 1964. And inherent in the Sun Belt strategy has been the party's sometimes unspoken and sometimes under Trump loudly spoken belief in white racism, basically, in white supremacy. And this year, you know, you can see it beginning to crack. You can see it in the fact that I think North Carolina and Georgia are actually going to go Democratic. And that the two mega states of the Sun Belt, Florida and Texas, are very much in play. Texas, I think, two reasons. Texas, because it was the first state which saw early voting exceed the total number of votes in 2016. And that's largely a huge turnout in the metropolitan areas, the cities, the big cities of Texas, which are heavily going Democratic, and the suburbs, which have been historically Republican, but clearly an increasing Democratic presence there, which is, by the way, one reason why the Democrats are going to pick up some congressional seats in Texas may even take one house of the Texas state legislature. In Florida, something that I think has been underappreciated is that there's a ballot measure to increase the state minimum wage, which is like $8.25, I think.
Okay.
To $15, which is what it is in a number of other states. I mean, obviously, this takes place over time. It's phased in over a number of years, but which has proved to be a fairly decent get-out-the-vote incentive to, you know, people who may not, you know, actually get out and vote. So Florida, which is historically, as I hardly need mention, a state that's been close for a long time, I think a good chance of going Democratic, and even Texas, which has been, you know, to Republicans what California has been to Democrats, even Texas is very much in play. And, you know, however the election turns out, and your listeners later in the week will have a better sense than I do right now, however it turns out, this really is an existential crisis for the Republican Party, because the demographic changes, which have been part of the reason the Sun Belt is in play, are only going to continue. The Latino share and other factors in the South and Southwest is going to continue to rise rapidly. That's why Arizona, I think, is clearly a state Joe Biden is going to win. This is a real crisis for the Republicans because it predates Trump.
Yes.
You know, the base of the Republican Party was anti-immigrant and kind of tacitly anti-civil rights for a long time. And that is not going to be a winning combination in American politics going forward.
Well, let me tell you something. You just informed me about something I was totally unaware of, and I feel terrible for not knowing this, that there is a ballot measure in Florida on the minimum wage.
That's right.
And let me, I've done Fox News a couple of times, and don't tell anyone. But anyway, but one of the things I talked about was the minimum wage. And we were talking about the fact that every single time a minimum wage referendum is on the ballot, whether it is in a red state or a blue state, it has passed. And this is the part you will love, Harold. They challenged me on it. Okay. The host challenged me. And I said to him, fact check me now. Now, in real time. And guess what? They go to a commercial, they come back, and who's correct? Moi. All right. Now, the reason I say this is that I go back to Florida is so interesting, because let's look at what happened when they restored the vote to ex-felons. That passed overwhelmingly, even though the Republicans have tried to stop it from actually going to fruition. So when I saw that vote, I'm like, what's happening in Florida? And now you're telling me that they have this referendum on increasing the minimum wage. And I am thinking, oh God, that would be incredible, because you're absolutely right. So now a lot of people who may not be incentivized because they don't necessarily make the connection between Donald Trump and their lives, and they may not see COVID and Donald Trump in their lives, but they will see a $15 minimum wage, and that could really hustle them into a voting booth, because without even a Trump or a Biden, they could see an increase in their incomes.
Absolutely. Now, there's one caveat about the Florida thing,
Okay. Which
is, for some reason, I do not begin to understand, the measure only passes if it gets 60% of the vote, not 50, which right. Sounds like traditional Florida crap.
Manipulation. Yeah.
Be
yeah.
that as it may, whether it requires 60 or 50 plus one, I think it's still a draw to the polls. And so the fact that it's on the ballot is a big deal.
And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but someone can fact check me about this. But my understanding is that restoring the vote to felons got about over 60%.
It did.
So let's remember, they've got the muscle. They've got the headset. They've got so many reasons now to go into the voting booth and vote. They're looking at COVID, and they know exactly who's getting killed with that sucker. You've got a bunch of old people who know that their number is up if COVID comes to them. There is such a synergy going on in Florida that really it could be pulled out. And that $15 minimum wage could actually be the tipping point, which I think a lot of us have focused on other things, but that could really bring an relatively unmotivated voter into the voting booth.
And in Florida, as in the rest of the nation, wow. Obviously the pandemic is a huge factor. And it's particularly a huge factor in Florida, because Florida has a disproportionately large percentage of seniors, voters 65 or over. And this is a group that Trump won, you know, almost by 20 points in Florida in 2016. And the latest polls show him in this group leading by maybe 4 or 5 points, if that.
Right.
And that's a big loss. And so, you know, there's been talk about, well, he picks up more because of linking Biden mysteriously to Venezuela and Cuba, which is news to anyone who's followed either Biden, Cuba, or Venezuela. I think the defection of seniors who are responding as much of the nation is responding to Trump's absolute failure to deal with the pandemic is a major factor that makes me think that Florida could very well go Democratic.
So let's talk about Florida seniors. A lot of them are from New York. A lot of them are wealthy, well-educated. I'll include my brother who just now moved to Florida and is now making Florida his home, and that's his fourth home. So that should give you, I mean, he owns four houses, so he's relatively well off. What I think is so fascinating is that in his last sort of closing remarks, Donald Trump was talking about firing Dr. Fauci. So here's that is the message to seniors. That's the message in the bottle, okay? Because they actually like doctors. They go to a lot of doctors. They can afford doctors. They actually believe in science because they have every ailment known to man, and they believe that a doctor can fix them. So in a way, his stem winder at the end of his campaign about firing Dr. Fauci is kind of like a direct message to seniors. You want this guy in power with your life? What was the point of making all those millions and having that very, you know, full 401k and that house in Florida? And you may not live to actually sort of experience that wealth. So it's just, to me, it's just so shocking that he would think that this is a message that anyone in Florida over the age of 60 would want to hear.
Well, you know, but Trump only talks to the Trump faithful. And I mean, that's strategically that's what he does. Emotionally, that's what he does. And I think, you know, if his consultants would, you know, have the cojones to tell him, hey, that's not really the best way to win the election, but it's what he does. And, you know, in a sense, you know, we need to thank, you know, Fox News and the talk radio right wing folks who create this echo chamber. And that's who Trump is talking to. In fact, you know, that's who Trump listens to as well. This is a man who gets his quote information unquote from Fox and Friends, you know. It's not at all clear that if that is your universe, that universe can prevail in anything resembling a fair election.
So I was watching a Trump ad on television. I'll admit to it. I couldn't avert my eyes. What could I do? And it was his ad about jobs, not moms. I don't know if you've seen that ad, no. Jobs, not moms. But the most amazing part of that ad is the last scene. And the last scene shows what looks like an Aryan youth. Okay. I mean, he couldn't have been blonder. He couldn't have been whiter. And he's kind of looking very macho and masculine. And that's the last face you see at the end of this ad. And I am looking at it. And I swear to God, it was the most non-subtle statement about this entire campaign. You know, you can't even have dark hair. You've got to be a blonde. You know, he loves those Norwegians, although they hate him. But I'm watching the ad and I'm just looking at him going, oh my God. I mean, he's not subtle, but in some ways he's such an invitation to all of us as to why you want to reject it. Because yeah, well, he is inviting the mobs. He's inciting the mobs. He's tweeting the mobs. And his ads are basically saying, you know, now your time has come. This is why you have the Second Amendment, to protect me.
Yeah, well, Trump and subtle don't rhyme. And, the white supremacy has been, stressed I think when historians look back on the Trump presidency, that's what they're going to emphasize most, because that has been sort of the foundation of Trumpism, is, you know, reclaiming the nation for white folks. Yes. And that's how he's going to go down in the history books.
Yes.
You know, and I don't think there are enough white folks who agree with Trump to keep him in office. But as I said, your listeners on Thursday will know more than me on Tuesday.
So I looked at David Dayan's piece at the American Prospect, and I loved it, because I think he's absolutely right that there is this sort of silver lining to this horrific time that we've experienced under Donald Trump. And it's not that we don't trust polls. That's not the story. The story is suddenly we understand that voting matters, that actions have consequences, that a democracy doesn't survive unless you participate. And the level of participation is mind-blowing. I mean, I cover Texas, so I have been watching for months as we've seen the change in Texas politics, and we've seen the rise in numbers in Texas politics. And I've said this over and over again, I have to thank Scott Braddock and Glenn Smith from Texas for teaching me, but they've always said that it isn't that Texas is a red state. It is a Republican state that doesn't permit voting. I mean, that's really what it is. There has really been a bar to participation. They've made it very, very difficult for people to exercise the franchise. And what's happened this time, in part because of COVID and how bad the governor has been in his response, in part because of Donald Trump, in part because of this incredible racism and the rise of the Latinx voting population, is that the more you say no, they're like my children, Harold. I am going to do it then for sure. You watch me. I'm going to crawl around it. I'm going to go below it. And in a lot of ways, that's what I love. But in a funny way, democracy needs that. It needs people to understand that kind of mindset.
It's not just your children, Arnie. I think that's everyone's children.
I know.
And that's our saving grace. And in fact, of course, in a place like Texas and in the United States as a whole, as you get the younger parts of the electorate, it gets more and more heavily voters of color, Latinos. That is America's exceptionalism, that this is a land of immigrants and a land where, you know, quote, the American people has always been a mishmash. And, you know, that's what we're seeing. But yes, to get back to my partner in crime, David, his article, absolutely. I think what we've learned is that democracy isn't just, you know, automatically there, something we can always fall back on. Exactly. It's something that needs participation, it needs renewing. And, you know, as David says, the value of Donald Trump is he's made the nation realize that, which it's very easy in what passes for a normal political year for a lot of people to say, well, you know, it doesn't matter, I don't have to vote. He has inadvertently caused a lot of people to change their mind on that.
Well, and the beauty of this is that they're not only just changing their mind because of this presidential race, but there are going to be consequences down ballot. And the consequences down ballot is also going to affect their lives. Because when they actually see Congress people I'm going to quote someone from yesterday. We had a guy on from Wisconsin who said that the Wisconsin Republican Party, especially those that control the legislature, have turned out not to be legislators, but litigators. They've forgotten how to legislate. And that is unfortunate, because in the end, what the people in Wisconsin, like the people in America, need is they need people to legislate. They need the policy prescriptions that will fix the things that happen. And so the benefit of what's happening this time because of Donald Trump is that they may see this ripple effect. I know they will see this ripple effect down ballot. And that ripple effect may be a state of Georgia or a state of Texas or a state of whatever that actually is beginning to respond to the yawning gaps in inequality and justice and infrastructure that these people have needed and the Republicans have starved.
Yes, and at the state level and at the federal level. I mean, you know, What is Mitch McConnell's Senate going to be remembered for? Judicial appointments, their version of litigation, to cite your friend, and nothing else. Other than that, they really didn't need to show up and vote. McConnell just didn't have anything to be voted on except the approved right-wing list of judges. The nation at a time of severe recession and pandemic needs more than the nothing that the Senate has enacted.
Exactly. So I've been dreaming, and here's my dream. So we control the Senate, and what happens, as you know, because of seniority, the person who becomes the chairman of the Budget Committee is a friend of mine, Bernie Sanders. I can't stand it. So I just want you, in the last few minutes of our Thursday session of the Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes, Harold Meyerson, what does that mean that Bernie, my Democratic socialist friend from across the river, is the head of the Budget Committee? And I want people to know chairmen are very powerful people.
Well, he can make America great again. Seriously,
I know.
The budget and the budget reconciliation, which only requires 51 votes, will encompass, if Biden's plans go through or even are improved somewhat by Democrats in both houses, includes major spending not only on the pandemic, but on infrastructure, on the caring society, trillions of dollars over the next decade to do what the nation needs. Now, I think the biggest thing we need to watch for in the Senate is it has to abolish the filibuster. Because that would be the one, minority empowerment thing that Republicans would use to thwart everything that can't be shoved into the budget that the Democrats would put forward. So it's very important that the Democratic senators get their heads screwed on right and decide that the radical concept of majority rule should be adhered to now and then.
Well, and I also do think that the Republican behavior from the time that Barack Obama got elected all the way up until now with Donald Trump has been so over the top. They've never extended a fig leaf. They've never extended a hand. They haven't done anything. And their incredible behavior has really, I know Joe Biden keeps talking about bipartisan. The bipartisan I want him to do is between AOC and Bernie Sanders. That's his bipartisan. You can do that. That's fine with me. You can call me later. But if he thinks he's going to be bipartisan with Mitch McConnell, no offense, sweetheart, but Mitch McConnell deserves to go on an island, assuming he wins even. And I really do think, I think you're right, we're going to have to get rid of the filibuster. And I think the idea that, Bernie Sanders is the chairman of the Budget Committee has to give a lot of people agita, but it makes me want to like pop champagne. And it's going to be a very, very interesting year. So I'm just going to recommend, I want you to dream, Harold Meyerson, and your next American prospect. What does Bernie do in the first 100 days on the Budget Committee? What a great article. What a great article. All right. Well, Mr. Meyerson, I'm hopeful, and I'm afraid to be hopeful that we're talking on Thursday and we will know more, even though you're on with me now. But I do think the greatest gift of Donald Trump is that now civics matters, politics matters, and the vote matters. And when I was running for Congress, I had an ad, and the ad that I had the sound of baseball in the background. But the words you heard me say was that politics is the place where I practice hope. Mm-hmm. And I've said that in 1996. It is now 2020. I say it again and again. And what is so amazing to me is now people are Facebooking me and saying, guess what, Arnie? Politics may be the place where I practice hope too. And if we can connect those two together, I think there's a future for America.
All of that plus the sounds of baseball. I like it all.
Listen, why not? I've only been to one baseball game in my life. Don't tell anyone, Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson is the editor at large at the American Prospect. Check out prospect.org to make sure that you get the best of sort of thoughtful conversation and thoughtful thought. Anyway, we'll be talking in about a week or two. And guess what? We'll have a lot more to talk about for sure.
Thanks, Arnie.
All right, ciao, bye-bye. All right, bye-bye. Stick around, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back.
This is our life, and these are the times. We are the people, and the dream is alive. Give us the strength to be humble and kind, and respect one another, leaving no one behind. From the mountains and valleys that stretch to the sea, a brand new America is calling to me. I am filled with emotion as the flag is unfurled. A brand new America and a brand new world. Lord have mercy. We all have a story, and we all have a prayer. We all are equal, and God is fair. So lift up your voice and let freedom ring. Be eternally grateful for everything. From the mountains and valleys that stretch to the sea, a brand new America is calling to me. I am filled with emotion when the flag is unfurled. A brand new America and a brand new world.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Believe it or not, we're Zooming this on Tuesday afternoon, so we do not know the results of the election. We can only hope and pray. But the conversations that we're having, both with Harold Meyerson and now with Robert Hennelly, are totally appropriate and they don't change no matter what happens on Tuesday night. So let me remind you who Bob Hennelly is. He writes for Insider NJ. He writes for Salon.com. He writes for The Chief Leader. He is prolific. He is at Stuck Nation. So if you want to sort of follow him there, you can go there as well. And the most recent piece that he put out was entitled Seizing Power Just to Have It. These are the times that reveal our souls. So let me welcome Bob Hennelly back to the program. How are you, Bob?
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into your piece, I was just thinking about something, and I saw a tweet that sort of reinforced what I was thinking. Have you noticed who's gotten very quiet in the last week? Bill Barr and Vice President Pence. I almost feel like they've moved on, that they are sort of preparing for life after the Donald. And laying low is what they're attempting to do. I mean, the fact that Barr has completely disappeared is in some ways amazingly shocking, because I guess he figured out he might not be employed after this, or he may have to move to an island like Aruba. But it is interesting that those people who played such a pivotal role in protecting or promoting Donald Trump have suddenly disappeared. And to a large extent, it even seems to sort of dovetail with the piece you wrote, because it's like Donald Trump is here, but when he goes, there'll still be a lot of rot around.
Right. And there is it is important to keep in mind that someone like Donald Trump is a symptom of something.
Yes.
And our national character has been deteriorating for a long time. And our politics has been, degraded for decades. And so we've had, and I think you can trace things, at least to my recollection, back to Richard Nixon, right? I mean, the accepted wisdom by Bob Woodward and mainstream journalists is that Gerald Ford did a great thing by pardoning Richard Nixon to heal the nation's wounds. And, you know, the reality is now that we know so much more about Richard Nixon, we know, for instance, from scholarship, because history isn't static, that he, as a private citizen, torpedoed the peace talks that Lyndon Johnson was on the verge of bringing to fruition, the Paris peace talks, and extended the Vietnam War single-handedly, which in a certain, through a certain prism, would look like treason. We know that he did a number of things that weren't captured in that moment. And then you also have someone like, for instance, Roger Stone, who was a young acolyte at the time, a bit player in Watergate. But because of the way that America's kind of attracted to this kind, these kinds of bad guys, he was able to actually parlay like a concierge relationship with Richard Nixon, who was in exile in Saddle River. And so Roger Stone built his reputation as a true believer who continued to cash in on that relationship and on the continued prominence of Richard Nixon, despite the so-called national disgrace.
Right, right. Well, you know, and so what am I still lamenting? That after the 2008 economic meltdown, not one banker did a perp walk. And, you know, and the and you talk about what's happened, at least with Ronald Reagan, with the savings and loan debacle, 1,000 bankers went to jail. And that compared to what happened in 2008 was a walk in the park. It was nothing in the way of enormity. It was nothing in the way of economic devastation. It didn't destroy the lives of so many people that are still destroyed because of what they did. And to see that they didn't go to jail, and then to see them get bailed out, and then to see them come roaring back, and then to see billionaires making billions during a pandemic. I mean, talk about rot with no consequence. You go back to Nixon and we can take it back to like yesterday. And I think this election is important because it is, you know, focused right now on Donald Trump. But I have a friend, Bill Curry, who keeps talking over and over again that the most important thing we do is deal with the corruption. And it isn't just Trump. And your piece at InsiderNJ and now at Salon.com is, I think, very important because it talks about the fact that it is not just Trump. Removing Trump is not the end of the story. It is the beginning of the job.
Right. And in essence, what's happened is this idea of systemic corruption is something that we have to keep in mind as we realize that, you know, this last election, this thing that we're going through, the reality is that it's over 3,000 county elections.
Right.
And so when we talk about an architecture of corruption, we have to imagine it as being really pervasive throughout our entire political structure. It's not just isolated in the main tent. It's something that's happened throughout our polity, and it's been going on for decades.
So I think the point of our conversation really is that you as you mentioned, we have 3,000 counties. That means that there's potential for corruption in each one of those counties, and they can do the corruption differently. We love the idea that there isn't like one-stop shopping, but in a lot of ways, that means there's like, it's like whack-a-mole. You've got 3,000 opportunities to do something incredibly disruptive, and you're actually seeing the power of counties in what's happening with this election. When people right. decide to actually start, you know, opening the ballots, when people decide to allow you to come in through like drive-by voting. I mean, every county is so autonomous in how they approach the vote. But wait a minute, if it's one person, one vote, then my chance to vote is different based on geography and the county I land in. And that means that I may be more deprived in one county and you may have greater access in another. That cannot be fair.
Well, you just described American Candyland, and that is exactly right. Where you land and your color. And the other aspect of this that is at work here is each county also has an interface with 50 states. And the character of each county and the officials in each county differ depending on the state you're in. And one of the things, one of the great disservices that's been done by Donald Trump is the fact that he has kind of played into our collective ignorance of our civics.
Yeah.
And so when he says that anything that happens in terms of counting votes after Election Day isn't of itself corrupt, he's absolutely describing a reality that the law has always been in these states. 22 states and the District of Columbia permit you to continue to count ballots as they come in after Election Day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, I think, so there's so many civics lessons that are being taught now because of Donald Trump's behavior. And yet the value of that is that they're going to be taught, I'm hoping, in perpetuity. So now people are going to be learning, oh, we stop voting on this day, but we don't stop, you know, actually opening ballots and counting numbers until maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks. What about all the people that are serving in the military that can actually post their ballot on Election Day? It doesn't get there from Germany overnight. You know, I mean, it's all these things. So, but when you give it a face, like, you know, someone in the military who'd be deprived the franchise, people would say, oh, no, that's not possible. They should be able to vote. Their vote should count. Well, people just don't know that. And a lot of this information is now finally forthcoming because Trump is basically denying everything, not only because of his lack of knowledge of civics, but because his base has never been curious because they've always done what they've been told to do.
Right. And I think the thing here is we've seen millions and millions of Americans engaged in politics in a way that's really unprecedented.
Yeah.
And the challenge is going to be to keep them engaged.
Yeah.
Because dislodging the corruption that is throughout the local political structures, and I include in this, by the way, the courts and law enforcement, there should be a convergence of interest here. Yeah. Because it's been my experience of years through years of reporting that where there is corruption, there's often white supremacy. There's a kind of like Venn diagram, if you will, wow, where there's a collision of those kinds of corrupt personal interests and indulgence of prejudice.
Wow. So in your piece, Seizing Power, Just to Have It, These Are the Times That Reveal Our Souls, I'm going to ask you to do something you've done only one other time, and that is to read something from your article. And it's incredibly, God, you can mine it for information. But I'm going to start by reading a paragraph that's entitled, I Am God. And as soon as I say I am God, everyone assumes I'm talking about Donald Trump. So it's great. You don't have to be cryptic here. But what I'd like you to do is then actually read the paragraphs called The Strong Man's Junta, because it really does speak to exactly what we've been talking about, which is, you know, removing Donald Trump doesn't fix it. It doesn't fix it, because what got Donald Trump to the altar, those people are still here. When you remove Donald Trump, those people are still here. And it's not just at the federal level. It's at the county level. It's at the state level. It's at the local level. And we have to become aware of the corruption, and we have to figure out how to get a handle on it in order to get rid of it. So here's what you write. There is a great temptation to blame our deteriorated situation entirely on this one man. This strain of toxic self-regard, when held by leaders, has always been a scourge on humanity that can result in a Jonestown scenario where one man's whim results in a mass suicide or in poverty and disease in a failed state. And actually, I've been thinking about this, and I'm going to actually now toss to you. And that is that it's actually kind of a form of genocide. I looked up the definition of genocide. And what Donald Trump is doing vis-a-vis his approach to COVID is actually that. Because not only does he have no plan, not only has he not prepared us, not only are we seeing an incredible spike in this, but when I was talking about why I vote for the 230,000 souls that have lost their lives. They can't vote, but I am voting for them. That's who I am voting for. So let's go from I am a God and this sort of disease of a failed state and talk about something more than Donald Trump.
Sure. Well, the strong man's junta. But a bullying autocrat can't rise to power or hold on to it without a cadre of supplicants and opportunists helping to make it so. Through their proximity to the tyrant, these mercenaries hope to improve their own circumstance by any means required, no matter how high the body count or how widespread the collateral damage.
Just in our own life, I just want to stop you. The how high the body count, 230,000 lives. That's just one example of one aspect of the body count, let alone his super spreader events, which they assume have caused the death of 700 people directly related to his super spreader events. So body counts are very important. Continue.
In our own lifetimes, we've seen this with the 2013 Bridgegate scandal, where a still unknown number of government officials and law enforcement employees conspired to target a town of tens of thousands with lane closures that provoked crippling traffic jams on the George Washington Bridge on a school day and during rush hour. Why? Because the town had elected a Democratic mayor who had refused to kiss Governor Christie's ring. When former U.S. Attorney for New Jersey Paul Fishman decided to prosecute the Bridgegate scandal, his, quote, pursuit of the case was a fig leaf of sorts that obscured the true extent of the rot at the heart of New Jersey's political culture, and in the long run actually reinforced it. The manipulation of the traffic on the George Washington Bridge on the anniversary of 9/11 was the masterpiece of David Wildstein, who's gone on to prosper as the editor-in-chief of the New Jersey Globe, which has been embraced by incumbents of both political parties. Wildstein pled guilty as part of a deal with the U.S. Department of Justice to take a turn as a star witness, and what ultimately turned out to be a very expensive and pointless show trial, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court tossing out the two convictions it did yield.
Unbelievable. Keep going, keep going.
Incidentally, in June of this year, Wildstein's conviction on two felony counts was itself overturned. As it turns out, the only thing worse than no justice is feigned justice. Over time, those who evade accountability can become stronger as they burnish their personal brands as can-do players who can take the heat and then go on to dominate our kitchen.
This is an incredible story. All right, keep going, keep going. The reason I want you to keep going is I want people to hear this. You know, you focused on the trial. People went to jail. The Supreme Court tossed it out. I mean, all these things, and they come back in another form. But guess what? The rot is still there. They may have put on a different hat and a different suit, but they are there. And now in some ways, as you point out, they're almost more revered because they survived this case.
Exactly. Oh, Fishman's multi-million dollar failed prosecution of public corruption gave the appearance of holding the Christie junta accountable. Yet with the way it was resolved, that architecture was left largely intact, including sealing from public view the identities of the, quote, unindicted co-conspirators who were on the taxpayer-funded payroll. And the names we do know, who are all most closely associated with the Roger Stone-style trans-Hudson dirty trick, Bill Stepien and former Governor Chris Christie, are crucial to President Trump's re-election bid. That would be the same campaign that includes efforts to actually undermine Americans' faith in the democratic process itself by not committing it to a peaceful transfer of power if former Vice President Joe Biden wins the election. Some might hope that just by turning Trump out of office, we can restore our national character, but that is ahistorical and ignores our soft spot for bullies and dirty tricksters that have been in our soil since Watergate, helping to bring this presidency to fruition.
Oh my God. I mean, everything in this article, I'm going to post it on Facebook. You just got to read it, take notes. But again, it is like whack-a-mole. They don't die. They don't disappear. Their form of corruption continues. It just maybe morphs into something else. So I got to ask this question. How do we fight it? Because has the media been so complicit in this? Is there a ka-ching involved with their failure to want to get to the truth? One of the most important things I thought about journalism and investigative journalists is that they expose this rot. Because even when the politicians can't admit it, or the CEOs want to ignore it, or there are no sort of voter consequences, it is the journalists that continues, like you, Bob Hennelly, to point it out to us to the point where we can't turn away. We can't turn a blind eye because it is having policy implications that are destructive on a level that is almost unimaginable today.
Part of it comes from the fact that the death of local newspapers has resulted so that at the county level, we don't have the witnessing that's required.
Right.
So that people are not being kept up to date. And at the same time, you have a situation where the stuff that is getting funded in terms of media it becomes this either this MSNBC on one side or Fox on the other, which is not so much about fact gathering, but by reinforcing people's biases, right? So there will be a lovely liberal presentation for you that assumes that you're in the club and you have the same outlook on things and you want to be in that tree fort. And then there's the Fox version or One American News. But the idea of actually going about sitting through trials, following the money, and all of that has diminished as the money in politics has dramatically increased. Right. And we now have social media platforms that are really bum-rushing our understanding of our own civic sphere.
Well, you know, we had a fellow on the air the other day, and he sort of said off the record, so I'm not going to say who the fellow was, and I'm not going to say, but a former attorney general in the state of New York was about to do some investigations of some prominent bank CEOs. And that former attorney general got contacted by a U.S. senator from New York who basically said, I really don't think that you should investigate this. I don't think that would be a good idea, okay? And when my friend who happened to be in the room when the AG took the call from the US senator, he said, oh my God. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. The other US senator does exactly the same thing. So what you talk about is that whether it's a Republican or whether it's a Democrat, the game is still being played. The protection of those CEOs is still happening. And as a result, you know, they may get their wrist slapped. They may get charged a fine, but the fine goes into the cost of doing business, and they are back to ultimately do incredibly destructive things, including what's happened now during this pandemic, where you see Wall Street doing incredibly well. You see billionaires making even more billions, as you see no one responding to people on food lines, people losing their jobs, possibly permanently, and facing eviction. I mean, you can't believe it if it was a movie script, but it's exactly the script that we have actually been writing.
Well, what we do see, though, is that in this crop of congressional candidates are coming forward that followed in the steps of AOC is increasingly an authentic connection to the circumstance of the people that they represent. And in that, I have hope.
Well, that was what I was saying to our fellow from Wisconsin the other day. Why did Bernie Sanders do so incredibly well in every single county in Wisconsin? Didn't he say, Ken, 71 of the 72 counties in Wisconsin supported Bernie Sanders? I mean, you can't
yes,
even
imagine. Yes, I don't know if I buy it, but that's what he said.
But that's what he said. But I think he's pretty accurate. But this is not this time. This was the last time around. The first time around, I think it was with Hillary Clinton. But the reason I think that Bernie is so successful, and to some extent AOC is so successful, is that people get a sense that they're seen by them, that what happens in their lives matters, that they understand it. And I may not have gotten elected in 1992 or 1996, but I remember going into places like Lisbon and Gorham and Berlin. And for the first time ever, they heard a candidate who understood their experience. Why? Because I had had my first baby born without health insurance. They did too. I lost my job and couldn't afford COBRA. They did too. I had my baby born in Cottage Hospital. They did too. And it was similar enough that they knew that I couldn't forget because it was part of my life experience as well. Am I right?
You know, right. Vote for you for vice president.
Oh, shush.
Also, the issues they speak to, though, Arnie, not just that you understand them and you hear them and you see them, but, you know, the issues that you raise and that you speak to are the issues that are going to make their lives better. It's not something that's going to line the pockets of some corporate CEO. It's something that really matters to them. You're going to give them more money per hour than
they're justified. And it's not that they're getting more money per hour. They're finally getting paid for their work. See, this is what people keep saying, things that make me crazy, Bob. It's like, oh, we can't add more justices to the Supreme Court. I said, yes, we can. We're adding more justice to the system. It's not about the person in the robe. It's about adding more justice to the system. You are not paying people more by giving them $15 of a minimum wage. You are paying them what they have earned and they have not received. And that's what's so important. What was amazing in the first half of the show, Bob Hennelly, is that Harold Meyerson told us something that I did not know, that on the ballot right now in Florida is a referendum on raising the minimum wage to $15. That is incredible. That's a wrinkle I was not aware of, but that also could help a change in the consequences of the election in Florida.
Well, I will tell you though, for whatever reason, the mainstream media, when a working class person does well making money, they get very upset. I'll never forget the stagehand union was having a beef with Carnegie Hall, and the Times found it so just scandalous that you could make six figures moving a piano that's worth all kinds of money. Meanwhile, they celebrate, you know, the billionaires as being, you know, people that should arbitrate our lives.
Right.
But if a blue collar person happens to do well, that's a problem.
Well, and the CEO's Christmas bonus is more than all of us combined earn in, 10 years.
Right. Exactly. And on that note, Robert Hennelly writes for Salon.com. He writes for Insider NJ. He writes for The Chief Leader. You can find him at Stuck Nation. And his most recent piece is also at Salon.com as well as Insider NJ. It will be posted. It's entitled Seizing Power Just to Have It. These are the times that reveal our souls. Removing Donald Trump, if it should have happened by Thursday or sometime in the next couple of days, it is just the beginning of the story. We have lots of work to do. And Bob Hennelly will help us figure exactly out who we should be figuring out to target and who we should remove. Bob, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Ciao. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
Together. your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulfstream waters, I tell ya, this land was made for you. For you and me.